Pulitzer Prize winner and UCLA professor Jared Diamond joins us this morning to discuss his new book, The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? When Diamond writes yesterday, he means it by a standard of 6 million years, how long humans have been around. State government on this timescale really did only arise yesterday. Before state government and modern technology, we lived in traditional societies, which range in population from a few dozen to a few hundred, but have no centralized government or king. Within traditional societies, there are no strangers, but tribes are constantly in warfare with their enemies. Once a traditional society encounters the outside world, as what happened in New Guinea when Europeans arrived, society immediately starts to change. They acquire steel, matches, and a colonial government, one that tells them to stop fighting. Jared Diamond documented the reasons why European invaders overwhelmed less technologically advanced cultures in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies. He laid out cautionary tales of social breakdown in the follow-up book, Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. And again, the name of the new book is The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? Diamond is a geography professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. Always a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, we were just talking about the issue of violence, and specifically violence in video games and violent media, and what effect it has on us as culture. Again, this is a blink when you think of us as humans and how long this particular material has been around. But since your name came up during the conversation, I am curious about your thoughts and in your research about what does it say about our effect that seeing and being exposed to violence going back thousands of years has on us as a culture?
That's an interesting question, and there's a interesting underappreciated perspective that we can get from traditional societies. Often we think of traditional societies as being peaceful, gentle, in harmony with nature. In fact, because of the lack of a central government that can start a war but also end a war, traditional tribal societies spend far more time at war than do modern state-level societies. And so the probability of violent deaths in traditional tribal societies has been much higher than in modern state-level societies. Even if you compare the worst of the worst in the 20th century, Germany, Poland, and Russia in the middle of World War II, the chances of dying a violent death in most tribal societies was higher than in Central Europe during World War II, because the war is just constant, and with tribal societies, not just the young male warriors, but also women and children are getting killed. So in fact, state government has, on the average, decreased the level of violence around the world.
This book, The World Until Yesterday, and this discussion of what we can learn from traditional societies is something that you have been looking at for nearly 50 years, 48 years, and specifically the field work that you have done in New Guinea. What brought you there originally, and how has that work progressed and transformed over nearly five decades?
Interesting questions. What got me to New Guinea originally was birds. I go out to New Guinea to study birds, 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 birds. But in New Guinea, every scrap of land is owned by people, and so I'm always with New Guineans who are these fascinating people from whom I've learned a lot. What I've learned that has most affected my personal life has been how New Guineans bring up children and how they treat old people and their attitudes towards danger. How my wife and I brought up our children was influenced by watching New Guineans give lots of independence to their children, let their kids make decisions, never, never hit their children. And my attitudes towards danger have been affected by watching New Guineans being very sensitive to the risks of rare events, which eventually will catch up with you. For example, today I did the most dangerous thing that I'll do all day. I took a shower. I've now learned from New Guinea to be very careful, because if I expect to take 10,000 more showers in my life, I'd better make sure that my chances of falling down and breaking my leg are less than 1 in 10,000 every time I take a shower. That I've learned from New Guinea.
You do talk in the book about what we can learn from tribal elders, and discussing the leaders and wise people of these traditional societies, at what point do you think we started to dismiss those as not being elders and looking to them for wisdom, but dismissing them and not taking that advice as seriously?
Good question. It came in a couple of stages. The first stage was 5,000 years ago with the invention of writing. With writing, now when we want to find something out, we look it up in a book or we Google it. Whereas in traditional societies without writing, if you want to find something out, you ask the old person. And so the invention of writing undermined one of the significant uses of old people in a traditional society. Another step has been in modern times with the development of technology. With technology, what I learned as a child is no longer useful, and I don't know the things that are useful today. So, for example, I used to be great at multiplying with slide rules and log tables and multiplication tables, but nowadays any idiot can multiply long numbers with a pocket calculator, so my abilities are no longer useful. But conversely, I'm holding in my hand now a television remote, which has about 52 buttons on it. I used to be able to turn on the TV set in my house when it had three simple on-off switches and channel selectors. But now with this 52-button remote, in order to turn on my television set, I have to call up my young sons and ask them to talk me through it. So that illustrates that old people have become less valuable because their knowledge is no longer up-to-date, but they lack up-to-date knowledge. Nevertheless, old people are of renewed value because of grandparenting, experience, the ability to synthesize. So the fact that I'm 75 years old doesn't mean that you should ignore me.
Well, right, because I come to you because of the 50 years that you have been studying this issue, for all of the research that you have done. I come to you to talk to you about it because you're not some kid right out of college. You are a man who has done a great deal in this issue, and it seems that we often look to the younger people for a quote-unquote fresh perspective and forget the people who have been actually doing it for decades.
An interesting example of that is that from time to time, so here you and I are talking about societies, and from time to time I'm asked to talk to hedge funds. And when I look at these audiences of hedge fund employees, most of them are in their 20s and early 30s. You look at the track record of hedge funds, and they last on the average 5 years, and then on the average in 5 years, hedge fund has gone bankrupt. That's because the whiz kids, they're great at manipulating the new statistics and the new methods, but they don't have the long perspective of having lived through a depression and a soaring of interest rates and the tech bubble. And so with hedge funds, the few older people in hedge funds of 50s and 60s, they're the ones who can spell the difference between survival and bankruptcy for a hedge fund.
It's like going into that tailor shop and having that guy look at you, the older guy, and have him look at you and say, "Oh, you're a 40 long, come this way." You know, it's just knowing is a lot to that. You know, this should have been the first question I asked you, and it wasn't. But your definition going in, and I'm curious as to whether this definition has changed over time for you, but the definition of a traditional society and what makes up a traditional society.
Good question. Traditional society is all societies that existed up to 5,000 years ago, and many societies today are still largely traditional. In practice, traditional societies mean small societies of a few dozen up to a few hundred, max a few thousand people. They're societies that lack a centralized government. Once you have a few thousand people, you can't make decisions face-to-face. You need a centralized government. But in the New Guinea societies where I work, of a few dozen up to a few hundred people, things get discussed face-to-face. There's not just, though, the change in centralized government. It turns out, fascinatingly, that traditional societies have different ways of raising their children, treating their old people. They have different diets and lifestyles. They never get heart disease or diabetes or stroke. They have different attitudes towards danger. Their religion is different. They tend to be routinely multilingual. So it's not just small size and centralized government, but with that come lots of other differences in their lifestyle and ours, from which I've learned and from which I think all of us, like everybody who reads my book, will be able to learn.
Let us go back to one aspect that you just mentioned, which is diet, health, and fitness. Why is it that these contemporary blights such as obesity and heart disease and diabetes are virtually unknown in these traditional societies?
Three reasons. One is that they have to exercise. It's not that they go down to the gym, but that their lifestyle is a strenuous lifestyle. That's one reason. Second reason is that what they eat is healthier. They eat lots of fiber. They tend not to consume salt, even no salt at all, or very little salt, little sugar. They consume lots of fiber. And then the third thing is that their food supply is limited. They don't go down to the supermarket and then eat a big meal as much as they want three times a day. Instead, they eat whatever food they can get. And normally, they're a little undernourished. Occasionally, they have a big glut. But I had my breakfast this morning, and I'm going to have lunch, and I'm going to have dinner. When you do that three times a day, every day of the week, all year, if you don't exercise restraint, and if you're taking in salt and sugar, you, like most Americans, are going to end up obese or overweight, and that brings on diabetes, heart disease, stroke, and cancers, and these other bad things.
This, like much of your work, is a big book with many, many big ideas. And one of the things that I found most fascinating about it is because much of it is positive of what we can learn, and as the subtitle suggests, what we can learn from these traditional societies. One of the things, and it seems almost a trend, and you make a prediction, that it is possible when it comes to languages, that many of these of our languages could be extinct by the year of 2100, which ultimately isn't that far away. And your discussion in the book about the benefits of being multilingual or bilingual and why that is so important, I found to be extremely compelling. Give us a sense of why you think we are moving in this direction toward extinction. Extinction to the point of like 95% of these languages going bye-bye. And why that is ultimately so important to keep these languages around and ultimately having us be familiar with them.
These questions fascinate me, too. As you say, the rate at which we are going now, the world's 7,000 languages are going to be reduced to a couple of hundred languages at the end of this century. The reasons are clear. State governments impose or offer their own national language. So in the U.S., to get ahead, you need English or a second-choice Spanish. If you've got another language, you better learn English if you want to be president. That's one thing. There's the internet, there are newspapers, media, there's getting a job. So everything mandates learning majority languages, of which there are just a couple hundred around the world. As for who cares about that, many people say, well, let's get rid of these 6,800 primitive languages. The fact is that each of these languages carries their own culture and their own literature. We would consider it sad if we lost Shakespeare. Well, any tribe also considers it sad if they lose their oral literature. But finally, if you say, well, what do we Americans care about those tribal languages? The thing that will grab you is that it's turned out in the last 5 years that the best protection, in fact, the only good protection against the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease of old age is being multilingual. Being multilingual gives you 5 years of protection against Alzheimer's. That's being bilingual. Being multilingual might give you more protection. So that's something that's turned out recently. That's an advantage to individual people from being multilingual. And I see from my watch that I'm going to have to run in 1 minute, but this is a really interesting subject to discuss.
Well, it certainly is, and you bring up so many interesting subjects in the book, and I thank you very, very much for joining us. The name of the new book is The World Until Yesterday. What can we learn from traditional societies? The book is published by Viking. Jared Diamond, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you very much for your interesting questions.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Again, Jared Diamond is the author of The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? The book is published by Viking. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.